A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I am your host for the day, Jules Gill, and I'm very nervous because Scott is away on his honeymoon and it's been left to the dregs to try and keep this going. But I will do my best for you lovely people. But I am joined, of course, by the lovely Ash Millman.
Hello.
And the equally lovely Josh Brown.
Hello, everyone.
But today, instead of speaking about niceties and pleasant things, we're going to be going into the dark and horrible world of video game fear creation, because I know that both of you have quite a vested interest in sort of fear creation. I mean, yeah. Ash, you are a massive horror fan. Before you worked here, you actually had a horror blog, didn't you?
No.
She did. She's just being a pain in the arse.
I had a film blog, but I covered mostly horror films.
There we go.
So, yeah, to be fair, yeah, but...
But being pedantically, yeah. No. Thank you for making this a very easy position as host. Josh, are you going to be equally difficult?
I'll try not to be, but it depends what you ask, Jules.
Do you like horror films?
Yes.
Okay.
No comment.
Okay, right. So explain why.
That was the genre that got me into movies. Mm-hmm. Some of my favorite games are horror games. Silent Hill 2, one of my favorite games of all time. Outlast is awesome, which I'm sure we'll talk about today. Mm-hmm. I did my dissertation on horror movies and like the mechanics of how they work and stuff, the psychological elements.
I thought you did a dissertation on pregnant women.
Yes. Yeah, it was mothers and horror movies and the combination of both.
Hey.
I have you to actually.
Oh,
thanks for remembering, though.
You kind of
did, yeah.
And I did my thesis on sound design in horror films. So between us, we should have a modicum of understanding of why video games implement horror and how they do it and why it's effective. Because the main discussion point today is, why are we so interested in horror video games? I mean, at its core point, fear is something that we do not want as a human. Like, that is something that our body is objectively telling us to get away from, the source of it. Either it's going to be something that damages us psychologically or physically. We don't want none of that. But in video games and film, we are drawn to it for some reason. There's a fascination with death and the occult and the macabre. And it's a strange one, isn't it?
That was a lovely pronunciation of the macabre there. It's interesting, though, because, I mean, yeah, we are drawn to it. Horror movies make so much money. Horror games make so much money. There are so many of them. People love making them, like, maybe because it's, like, the accessibility of the genre or something. But when the Steam boom happened in, like, 2012, 2010, with, like, the genre and stuff, Amnesia came out. Everyone was making these sort of cool, innovative horror games, and it was a real creative space. I just think horror genre, no matter the medium, is such a creative endeavor that's completely overlooked, tragically, by, you know, the elite who don't deem it true art or whatever.
It's weird, isn't it? Because they do seem to be, like, in the public mind quite often. Maybe is it because of the fact that they are something that you can talk about and it's a shared experience? Maybe it's because if something scares me, I want to show you to get validation
and
the fact that I'm scared by
it. I mean, me and Rach did the stream last night and Laser for you too, and it's like it is a good shared experience. Like, when you have someone there, it works both as a collective thing and as an isolating thing, where you just, you've got your headphones on, you're entrenched in the atmosphere, and you're having to change your pants, essentially, because you've had an accident because Laser Fee is too scary.
Putting the brown in Josh Brown last night.
Exactly like that.
Extreme, was it? You know, I think horror is such a social experience where you go with other people, you can all chat about it afterwards, you can say, oh, okay, this scared me, this doesn't. But I think the main thing that is appealing about horror as a genre, both as games and as films and as every other little piece that you can consume, is that it isn't real. So everything that you go into within games and films is a safe space for you to experience something horrible and horrifying without, but whilst knowing it's never actually going to get into you and in your head and get you. So it's like a way of experiencing our own like horrible, morbid curiosities without consequence.
It's kind of, I think that that term's got a name, hasn't it? I think it's sort of called quasi fear or quasi fear, where it's like you're,
quasi,
yeah, yeah, you're kind of put, you're put into a like a almost catatonic state when you're watching a film, but you're subject to the material and you're just you're allowed to process it that way. It's why we therefore give agency to what we're watching rather than ourselves, and but we take on their actions as fear for ourselves.
Yeah.
But it's interesting when it comes to video games, because I'd say that film horror is totally different to video game horror, and it comes down to simply, while you might be able to implement the same techniques as jump scares or cats appearing out of garages, as remember that thing in Scream, like in video games you are in control of the player more, so therefore that extra level of agency, do you guys think that that makes video games potentially more frightening?
Well, for me, this is like, this is the cool thing we're going to get into, because there are pros and cons to this approach. I do think it makes it way more immersive, and of course I'm going to mention VR, because when you're in there you're actually in the horror space, it's terrifying. But the fact that you have, you're an active participant in the horror itself, can make things, in my opinion, way scarier than they are just watching something play out on a screen. But at the same time, it's far more difficult to pull horror off effectively, I think, when you give players freedom and control over characters, because horror works in movies, I think, because it's so well directed and well scripted. Like, you need to really pace it well for a scare to pay off. Whereas you free some of that control up when it's a video game and you actually let the player sort of, you know, essentially co-direct the scene with you. They're in charge of like the camera angles and like the setting and the jump scares and when it's going to happen. But the player is fundamentally in control of how they navigate the world.
Oh, I mean, the amount of times that I've accidentally missed a horror moment, like in Dead Space 2, you know, the very infamous scene where the mother calls over the baby and the baby explodes like afterwards. I missed that the first time around. So I didn't have a clue what everyone was on about. So I just walked past and saw this massive red smear on the wall because I'd heard it happen. I was like, that sounds really scary. What's going on there? Turn around and start like, what's this jam?
it's kind of like the trust you put in a player as well, because obviously the thing for movies is the less you show the monster, the scarier it is, because your imagination fills in the blanks. When you have a monster that you can go up close and personal to in a game and just sort of stare at and look at the polygons making it up, the fear is suddenly disapparated.
Mr. X.
Mr.
X is terrifying, but when you see that he can't get into that safe room in the Resident Evil 2 remake, you just look at me like, well, aren't you a big silly?
No, I think this is the whole active-passive thing. I think in films, there's the directed side of it, but in games, because everything revolves around death and the mechanics that are related to death, you're not going to survive all the time. So there's something that takes it away from games where you have to repeat the same thing over and over. We spoke about this in our like film and game podcast, but as soon as you start dying and you start redoing things and you get the repetition, it drastically changes it from the horror you get in a film.
I can
and
see
has
that.
To work a lot harder. I personally get a lot more from films than I do from games, but I do really respect horror games and love them and want to engage with them and everything. But I think the scariest moments for me are the ones that are in films, because you don't know when they're coming, you don't know what they are, you don't have any preparation for it in the same way that you do in a game where you can die and redo and go over. But
So what we're going to do now is we're going to walk through what makes a horror game scary. Imagine like we're trying to build a horror game together. Like, what aspects do we need to address in order to make our product the scariest that it could be? I guess the first thing we need to do is define what type of horror we are going to try and implement, because there are a few different types of horror that are, some are easy to create. I'd say that shock or jump scare stuff is incredibly easy. You could walk into a room, have a face pop up onto the screen, and you've made the person jump, like Five Nights at Freddy's sort of thing. But is that effective horror? That's that, because that's an immediate response that has an immediate end.
I think, for me, jump scares, I don't hate them as much as other people do. I think they can be really well utilized when they're mixed in with other elements. If that's all you've got, if all you've got is a loud noise at the end of like your sequence, then you need something more. Because like you said, that's such a in-the-moment response to it. You do get jump, you do have a jump, and then you like laugh along with everyone else, and the moment's gone, and then there's no sustained tension. So I think that can work as a payoff, but you need to have sort of some wider sense of dread and atmosphere to sort of make sure that once that jump scare pops off, all the tension isn't broken. Yes, there's still a sort of like a sense of immersion there.
Like, atmosphere is the key concept to it, really. I mean, what games can you guys think of that, like, have...
What, for atmosphere? Or
yeah, like what would you say is, like, a quintessential atmospheric game?
I think Outlast is great because, like, which you're in a mental asylum, so you're like, whoa, okay, that's very classically spooky, and you have to look through your, like, found footage lens and everything. I think that's a great atmospheric one. Amnesia as well, because of the whole sanity thing and being underground. I think most... If a horror game isn't atmospheric, it's doing its job wrong.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I would always point that Resident Evil is one of the strangest franchises. I mean, you're a huge fan, isn't you? Because a lot of people call them the granddaddy of horror games, coming out in 1996 with Resident Evil 1. And trust me, that was a scary game when I played that for the first time.
When I was younger, man, my dad used to play it and I couldn't watch the screen. I was so terrified.
It's terrifying. But now you look at that, and let's leave Resident Evil 7 out of the equation for the moment. Get to Resident Evil 6, you put those two games side by side, you wouldn't even be able to tell that they're from the same franchise, because it's an action spectacle that doesn't reward horror in the same way. It's just more like, here's a thing that has five limbs, it's scary now. Like,
look at all the eyes, you know. Yeah. Like, no.
So it's interesting how, like you say, even like within its own franchise, it can be hard to balance what horror is or how to deliver it.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Because, I mean, again, going back to the building things, atmosphere is definitely one of them. Mm-hmm. Sound is definitely one.
Oh, yeah, which ties incredibly closely to atmosphere, because if you're not getting the, ooh, what's that? There's such an intrinsic link between human fear and noise. Like, even the smallest things, like we are programmed as babies to be terrified of a couple of things. I can't remember the other ones, but one of them is loud noises is something you'll always be scared of throughout life, because it's a primal instinct to be afraid of it. So it's like sound is one of those things that will get you if it's a loud spike. And there's so many scientific studies on how different, like, resonances of voices and spooky, like grudge noises. And
thank you for the...
like, set something off in you to go, whoa, there's some danger, that sets the fight or flight response in you. And, like, again, babies again, when they're crying, like, the primal response is to be like, oh, okay, there's danger, I need to look after this. Like, it sets off nurturing things. We've got so many, like, markers in our bodies that respond naturally to noises that horror's going to take advantage of that to the best degree.
I don't know. Have you guys played Alien Isolation yet?
Yeah.
We played it.
We did
the bold leading the blind.
Which I still love. You talked about that like all yesterday.
I love it, man. I really want to play it again. It's one of the best games that I can think of for sound design, because not only did it try to really honestly recreate the sound from the movies, which is great because then it instinctively links that fear of aliens to the films itself much better. But they were a huge proponent of the use of binaural audio, which is when you've got audio coming from any direction, but you're meant to be able to piece it together using your imaginary headspace, I guess, is what you'd have. So hearing the footsteps of the xenomorph clumping behind you like Ash Millman in her big boots. Like,
yeah, big baby!
Boom! Boom. Yes,
my
I say,
God!
Yeah, I know, they're huge. And then having that creep around the front into your actual vision, that is a really, like, important piece of horror for
me. I keep going about it. It's a bit of a joke, but that's genuinely a huge part of why VR works so well. Like, we saw it a bit in Hellblade, like a non-VR game, the way that you use 3D audio to sort of put you in, like, this character's headspace, and you have, like, the voices all over the place. But in VR, even in, like, a demo, like the Resident Evil 7 demo, the kitchen demo, like, you're literally just... It's more of an experience than a game. You're just, like, strapped to a chair while this creepy demon is, like, around you. But, like, the use of sound in that is so good. Like, it tricks you to, like, look up there, and, like, when you're doing there, it'll hit you with a noise down here. That's, like, you turn around, there's a head there or something like that. But it's just, like you said, Ash, it's like a primal thing. Like, when you're in that space and you know something is there, it's like when you're in control of the actual act of looking. It's something you don't get in a horror movie. In a horror movie, you're like, don't look at it. Like, please don't look at it. But you're ultimately not in control. And there's something special about being in, like, having the ability to control vision, knowing something is behind you or potentially behind you because you can hear it, and having to slowly creak your neck around to see what is happening. That is just so terrifying.
But then there's a whole other part of horror games where you can just go, no, thank you, and I run the other way. Because every time I play them, I'm like, nope, sorry, bye. Like, run down the corridor. Like, I can hear something coming. I'm going to go through this door really quickly.
That's why I really like Resident Evil 1. Yeah. And actually, up to Resident Evil 3, because of the fact that they use the static camera angle. visuals, and therefore you could have enemies off screen that the player wasn't able to see, but they were able to hear them. Case in point, the very first zombie that you encounter in Resident Evil 1, you hear that munching, that crunching noise. You go down the corridor and you walk forward. You only get to see it, the room, for a split second before the FMV is cut. And that is a fantastic creation of anticipation. What am I about to see?
Munch and crunch.
Yeah, having a good old munch and crunch. Yeah. And then you finally see it and you're like, oh my God, it's a zombie. That
Jesus. Oh, he's eating his face.
That's not his dinner.
Yeah, so I mean, like, it's like using masking what the player can see is definitely an important one. I mean, games use lighting to great effect in horror games. I mean, we can all think of countless examples of when you've not been able to see, like Amnesia, you pointed out before, like, has the lantern, and when that goes, then you're like, you know.
Well, again, like Outlast, I think that not only plays with horror genre conventions like so well, but the idea of having to use a camcorder that you're hyper aware of its battery life, but you need it to like see in the dark and stuff. I think that's such a great way to play with lighting in a way that isn't just the conventional sort of, oh, this is shrouded in darkness. Like, you're in control of it again. You're looking around. You have to turn it on and off because you need to conserve the battery. And that's just like sort of terrifying.
Yeah.
Thing. And especially for me, Silent Hill 2 is the game that perfectly blends both like lightning.
Whoa.
Both lighting and sort of like those static camera angles. Because even though they aren't there all the time, when you go into buildings, the camera will swap from like one place to another. And I think that manipulates it so well, the idea of something you can't see. I always remember this one unscripted jump scare. I think it's unscripted jump scare that got me. I was playing Silent Hill 2 for the first time, and I was exploring a room I thought was that had nobody in it. It was just deadly silent. It was like no noise at all. And I walked into another part of the room, and it switched to the other perspective. And I thought, that's fine. I've checked this place out. There's no one behind me. And then suddenly this creature walks across like the doorframe like this, with like just complete silence. And I just stood still. And I was like, I'm not going back in there. I don't. This was supposed to be safe. Yeah. This is not safe. And I was like, that's brilliant. Like, all you've done there really is change the perspective, and you managed to create such a palpable sense of dread that if you were in control of the camera, you might not have even seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's
something to be said for safety. That's like an actual massive part of it, because again, it's creating this safe space to explore these fears and stuff, but in your own home, and then creates others within the game where you think, okay, I've done this, I've done that and the other, and then it's breaking that false sense of security, isn't it? That's the whole thing.
I think that's what games can do so well, because we have, especially now, there is such like a homogenized set of mechanics that we expect to be in every game. When you play a Resident Evil game, you know that a couple headshots should take the bad guys down, but even Resident Evil 2 recently subverted that in such a great way, where headshots weren't really rewarded. Yeah. They did nothing, and a lot of people were annoyed at that, but that was such a great way to sort of create dread, because the old tricks didn't work. Everything you thought you knew was wrong, and then you didn't know. You genuinely were like, oh my God, I have no idea how to deal with these enemies now. Yeah. And I think that's such a great way to create dread by not necessarily what you're seeing on screen, but the response that you're getting from the actual controls and mechanics, which is cool.
I mean, like, in general, just having control manipulation, like you were pointing out with VR, it's a new way to play it. Yeah. Resident Evil 7, obviously it was first person. There's tons of first person, like putting the immediacy on the player. But even in games like Resident Evil, when they were using the tank controls, that a load of people really hate those tank controls. And I can understand why. But my argument is that actually elevates the amount of fear that you experience in that game, because you don't have a responsive character control that you can just get out of a situation. Mm-hmm. If you walk forward and you've walked into an enemy, what are you going to do? Spend time turning around slowly to walk back? Or are you going to try and back up, which makes it even more terrifying?
Yeah, I mean, I love those tank controls, to be honest. I played Resident Evil 1 quite often, and I've got the HD remastered version, so I could change the controls, but I refuse to, because it just adds so much to the experience, in my opinion.
Me too. I don't play with the updated control scheme, because I find that it's really weird having the... I feel like it's two games meshing in a way that doesn't really work. I know a lot of people would disagree, but I prefer playing it in the classic way, because that's just how I feel it was meant to be. It was made.
A weird thing is, you know, in The Evil Within 2, which I think is a really great horror game, by the way.
I've never played it, actually.
I would fully recommend it. Okay. It's like one of my favorites of the generation so far. But at the start of that, like
just drop that like a real casual one.
Generation so far.
It's really good. Yeah. But at the start of that, obviously, because you can level up your character, so your guy can't shoot straight for crap, you know what I mean? Like, the reticule is all over the place. But I was sort of hesitant to actually upgrade that because I thought that added so much to sort of like the sense of dread and like the unpredictability of your shots. Like, I can't even control my aiming because these bullets are going to miss, and these bullets are really sort of things I need to preserve. And it just made the game more intense. And once I could just pop headshots off left and right, it was fun. But there was something, it was like something that was diminished there.
Is that not a massive argument for the active and passive thing again, though? That the cinematic, filmic sort of quality of horror is the thing that is entrenched the most in fear, because the less control you have, the more you're like, oh crap, what's happening to me? Like,
although I would say there's nothing more where I felt my arse sink through my stomach.
Like, you held your heart up
From here right down to there is when I've missed. When you fire and you miss and you've only got... Because obviously another feature of horror games is resource management and the survival horror aspects of it. So scavenging together, say, 5 bullets, you know the enemy in front of you takes at least 3 to take down. Yeah. You've whiffed the first shot. I'm like, oh, God. 1 adult nappy, please.
I think it's... I agree with what you're saying in a way, Ash, because I do think it's sort of like you need that element of control. But I think it's also giving the player enough control to make them feel like they don't have it, if that makes any sense at all. Like, there is sort of like, it's well directed. It's well directed and stuff, but it's like the perception that you're not actually in control of your character. It's kind of weird. It's like there are machinations bigger than you. You're just sort of part of the world and you're doing as best as you can, but you're sort of being punched down by all of these other sort of like, I don't know, rules of the game, essentially.
Maybe it's kind of like comparing the two of like a theatre experience is like a roller coaster and a gaming experience is like a maze. Because it takes you are control, but you're still working within a thing that only has one solution.
Yeah.
And you can take dead ends and you learn from your experiences. Now, which is more fun, a maze or a roller coaster? That, I mean, maybe those two aren't equivalent on that because I'd rather be on a roller coaster.
Don't ask Rich Hudson that, because I mean, I know his answer. And I know what his answer would be every time that a roller coaster is mentioned in that question.
His ears are probably bricked up right now.
It's running. Oh, roller coaster, was it?
The thing that I really like about horror games is that they place a real importance on certain items and the character's inventory.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you get a handgun early on in the game or you get a knife or a shotgun, it tells you that this is a really important thing because it will prevent whatever is going to attack you from attacking you. Fine. By limiting the amount of ammunition it gives you, by having weapons degrade or break, it removes that. And it's all about depowering the player. As Joss was saying earlier, it's about when you've got the wavy reticle.
Yeah.
It's that feeling of non-empowerment that makes you feel scared because you're like, I could be killed by anything.
Yeah. This is what I want to ask you guys about, actually. Because obviously Amnesia ushered in that boom of first person sort of almost walking simulator-esque like horror games where you're essentially, you've got no weapons, nowhere to fight back. All you've got to do is not look at the monsters and run, which I think can be quite good, but I prefer when you are given some sort of way to defend yourself, whether it's like a gun or like some kind of weapon. But that weapon has faults, like you said. Like, you've got limited ammo, you've got something to be worried about, because then you can fight back, but it's always the worry that you might not be able to. Whereas if there's only one solution to the problem, that's just run away. That, for me, gets repetitive, and that's why some of these games don't work, because if you just keep getting caught over and over again and you have to... you are funneled down this one solution to the problem, it's kind of like, oh, I can see the game's, like, stitches sort of coming apart. It's like coming apart at the seams.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
No, I agree with that, actually, because the amount of times if I've, say, failed a stealth mission or failed a stealthing thing where the only way I can get past is by hiding and waiting and I have to reset it again to do that, that does get frustrating because it's hard to be afraid of something when you're getting angry at it.
That's it. That's exactly it. And that's what, for me, I love Outlast, but Outlast 2, I love the atmosphere of it, but that sort of frustrated me because I didn't think the level design was quite up to snuff in that it was more open, there were more dead ends, there were more ways to get caught, and once you got caught a few times, once you saw the same animations over and over again, the fear was just gone, like you were too comfortable in the situation, and like you said, I was angry at it rather than being scared at it.
I think the best horror games are the ones that combine both, like Alien Isolation, where you've got a xenomorph coming after you, but you're fighting off humans and that sort of thing, robots. So you've got some autonomy over what you can do, but when the big bad comes, you're like, oh crap.
Sorry, Karen.
My foot in my mouth went, what? Hellblade as well. I think that that one mission where you have to go through all of the horrible swamp monsters because you're blind and the what's-his-face is leading you through. The man is leading you through after you've been absolutely hacking apart all of the Northmen, and then you have to go and sneak past all of the pulsing brains in the water. I thought that was great. I thought that was actually really, like, scary.
Yeah.
And that was because it swapped it around, and that was the change in control. I think that's a really good way of horror building its own atmosphere and mythos that gets you invested.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It was just when you mentioned Alien Isolation, I remembered a little bit of information from it, which is that the way that the alien was programmed had a very interesting story. There are actually two AIs running on that character of the xenomorph, and one of them is telling the... one of them knows where the player is. The other one controls the xenomorph's movements and actions. And what it does between these two AI is the one AI that knows where you are gives the other one clues. And that's how it works. So that's why it has that real feeling of a lived character. Because if you stay there long enough, the xenomorph will go like, okay, so it said near a vent. Okay, so I'll go near the vent. Okay, it said near the vent and under a desk. And then it's like, oh, now I know where you are sort of thing. So if you stay in one place, it will find you. And I love that there is so much effort being put into some horror games to make you feel like you're not just fighting an enemy, you're fighting something as smarter as you. Again, when Mr. X shows up in Resident Evil 2, until maybe he got overused, it was scary to just go, run down a corridor, I'm fine, I've just knocked off this zombie, and then all of a sudden it's like, clump, clump. Oh no.
Not this guy again.
Yeah. Here he comes.
No, I think another strength of horror games that we've got to go into at some point is how they, horror in general, its whole strength is being able to distill actual societal, real human fears into weird amalgamations of that are like physical manifestations of that. So like William Birkin being this whole like weird fleshy eyeball man that attacks you like this.
Is that how he attacks it?
Yeah,
that's just being a Saturday night. Like what you were
transforming.
Well, I mean, rise, oh God.
But yeah, so and The Evil Within as well, and PT with Lisa, all these people that have like strange, uncanny qualities about them where it's the known, but it's not as you know it. Like that's the and gaming as a whole is that medium because it's the known. It's all these people and humans and things that we see every day, but in pixels, which already distorts it. And then to put horror on top of that is like, oh, brother. Like
it was like, because we were talking about this at the, we went to the Sinking City preview launch event yesterday, and we were talking about Sigmund Freud's uncanny theory that basically what scares us the most is when something looks like a human but does not act like a human, because it's the closest that we can do to looking in the mirror, but it's the furthest from understanding it, and it's not understanding something that gives something fear. And that is something that you cover quite a lot in your series, which is on video game enemies and what they represent.
Plug, plug, plug.
Yeah, see how I did that right there? So, I mean, like, and you've got to look at things like Silent Hill. That franchise is rife with so many hidden meanings as to why this is terrifying. Like, have you guys ever met the rather awful creature that's... it looks like a big lump on a bed, and I can't remember its name, and it's called something like Daddy or something like that. And
I have.
No, no, it's rough, man. It's basically like meant to be the manifestation of this woman whose family like sexually abused her.
Oh, okay.
And
this
that's
anymore.
Why I was like keeping it.
Jules is keeping his tone down because he knows what's coming next.
So obviously you have it. So fighting against that has that instilled fear of just like what is this manifestation of horror and pain? Like,
asphyxia, I always think, is a great one. The Homecoming, whereas the fear of like strangulation, not being able to breathe and oxygen and all that sort of thing. Because like watching someone drown is obviously in games and films and everything like that. That's a really scary thing because it's real. Mm-hmm. And then the way that they distill the fear of not being able to breathe into this big slug lady that's then got like hands over her mouth is just a great way of interpreting that and putting it on something that's really quite grotty.
This is kind of why I disagree with you, Ash, in that. Like, obviously, you know, there are problems with death mechanics in, like, video games and that can suck out some of the tension and stuff. But for me, like, just getting killed, even though death is obviously very scary, like, the idea of just dying isn't, like, what drives my sort of fear of horror movies. It's stuff like that. It's like what these creatures, uncanny creatures, sort of like represent and what's happened to them and what do they sort of reflect back to me about my wider fears of not just like death but like society and myself and identity and everything like that. And then that's what sort of freaks me the hell out.
I guess there's a lot more I agree. In films you obviously get the weird creatures that have all these representations that are wonderful and have all of these different connotations and stuff, but you aren't the one facing them head on, I guess. Like in a film, you're watching someone else be like, oh, wow, that's pretty scary, guys. Look at this. Whereas in a game, you're like, oh, there it is in my face. That's not nice.
Well, an interesting one is to maybe compare a film that was made of a video game. And the site, have you guys seen the Silent Hill film?
Yes.
The Silent Hill film.
Right. It's pretty decent. Now, this thing, as a film, it's serviceable.
Yeah.
But
it does not
encapsulate the same level of fear simply because it completely misses the point of why Silent Hill 2 was so effective. In Silent Hill 2, the main character sees the sexy nurses, sees pyramid heads because they are a representation of his sexual aggression, frustrated sexual aggression, and his frustration towards his wife and the lack of health care that she received in his eyes before he then murders her. Spoilers. But in the film, you see the sexy nurses and you see Pyramid Head, but they're attacking a woman who has nothing to do with this, has no connection to why they, her sexual repression or anything like that.
Yeah.
There's no connection to them, so it's just fan service.
Wholly agree, right? Because I love Resident Evil, one of my favorite franchises of all time, but I don't find the monsters really scary, with a few exceptions, like the idea that they've just got loads of eyes because it looks cool, and these monstrosities because they kind of look scary on paper, but they don't have that sort of deep connection to sort of like human fears, or they don't have that same context. And it's exactly what you said there. That's why those movies aren't as scary, because they are the same monsters, they are the same designs, and they look really good when they're blown up on like created on film, but they're devoid of the actual sort of context that makes them even scarier in the first place and resonate more than just like, oh my god, that has lots of sharp tendrils.
I mean, imagine like watching Night of the Living Dead for the first time back in 1960. Like, that would have been terrifying because of the fact that up until that point, zombies weren't really a thing in cinema. And it's why they're such a popular horror figure, that because it's the human, but the furthest from the human. So it is, at its principal core, the most scariest thing that we can do, because it looks like Josh, it smells like Josh.
Probably is Josh.
Probably is Josh, but it ain't Josh. And therefore, like, what's going on here, brother? So, like, so in video games, though, and film, it's the oversaturation that's killed the fear. And that's another thing that you need to be aware of when making a horror video game.
Yeah.
Because if your enemy, if you're going to base it on zombies, for example, you can end up aiming to make the next Resident Evil in terms of a fear creative point, but you could end up making Dead Rising, which literally plays them off for laughs.
Yeah.
So
I mean, exactly. And I think they have an even bigger problem in that not only is it the monsters themselves or like the situation themselves, which are repeated and perhaps like you get to a level of fatigue with. It's like the mechanics themselves. I keep going back to that, but it's sort of like, like, again, there was a rise in sort of stealthy walking simulator horror games, but that those kind of died out because you were doing the same thing over and over again. And when you, when sort of the reaction to scary situations is just like entrenched in your muscle memory, that stops being scary because it becomes familiar and becomes like just something you can treat with, you can treat really easily. And it's like you need to get away from, you need to get away from that and start sort of subverting expectations, which again is why I think Resident Evil 2 works so well.
There's a whole, the whole thing that it all boils down to, guys, is that the essence of horror, the seed, the nugget of horror is
Never have I heard it. I want to see you with a clenched fist saying the word nugget again.
It's the fear of the unknown.
Yes.
And the more you repeat something, the more that you keep bringing it back, and the more you know it, so the less scary it becomes. You don't want the same thing over and over again. And there's nothing more unknown than the afterlife and death. Yeah. Death is the epicenter of all of our unknown mysteries of the world, because it's a thing that happens to us all, but we don't know what the hell happens afterwards because it's impossible to. So I think that as long as a game can claw itself in to the unknown, not and make something new, even if it's not necessarily scary as in like, oh my God, there's blood and gore everywhere, as long as it can find that and find a spin on what comes after, like zombies, what comes after, very scary, and death mechanics and that sort of thing, that's where they're going to have their whole hinge of success or not.
Well, it's an interesting one because I'm seeing a slight rise of horror games that are doing away with any enemies whatsoever. And you'll find there are certain games that I don't know if you guys have played Gone Home and what happens to Finch and stuff like that. Like, some of those areas are really scary because it is just you. It's the fear, it's the isolation that actually is the key point of horror. Like, even games like Everyone's Gone to the Rapture, it's set in an idyllic Somerset town with sun and really nice cheery music in some places. But because you are alone, that is terrifying.
Yeah.
I think it's for me, it's exactly that. That's what I'm the more scared of, I think I've realized, is like both in games and movies, it's when your perception of reality especially is just sort of warped with. There's something that looks like what you expect, but you're in this sort of weird nightmare version of it where nothing quite makes sense. You're in this lovely idyllic British countryside, but everyone's gone and what's happened? You're in a hallway in PT and you've got someone watching you, but it just repeats and repeats and repeats. That's not how hallways work. And I'm really scared by it. I love it when games do that. It, like, Layers of Fear, for all of its problems, has such a great way of sort of like making you navigate this surreal space that is just sort of close enough to reality to be believable. You know that it's a ship. You know that this hallway should connect to this, but then it doesn't. Or you've got it locked on. You turn around, you're in a completely different place. That kind of idea that not only are you facing up against like these terrifying creatures or whatever, but you literally can't trust your own eyes, which is that's a sort of theme of horror that I love it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, PT, some would argue, is one of the best horror experiences you can play. However, I'm going to be that devil's advocate and say, would that make a great game? Because
we will never know, will we?
No, but this is this thing. Everyone was raving about it. Everyone says that it's just so, so good. But no one really considers what the final product would have been, because it wouldn't have just been 30 hours in a corridor. Unlikely that that would have been the case. It probably would have been much more open world. We see Norman Reedus' character exit, and it would have gone on from there. So therefore, as a contained experience, yes. Ticked all the horror boxes. Had great sound. Messed with lighting. Messed with expectations. Had death. Had screaming and loud noises.
Oh, I love screaming.
Like, literally no, all the things we've talked about, it had what would make it great. But continuing that over 30 hours, that's the real problem.
Don't make it 30 hours is the answer.
That's true.
The best horror games are the shortest ones. Among the Sleep, not the perfect horror game, but I think it's great because it's just snappy little, okay, I'm going to go around, I'm a baby, what's going on? Oh my God, there's monsters everywhere. Like, have you guys played that?
No, I've not played that.
Okay, well, you're a baby, there's monsters everywhere.
You basically, you're a baby.
You play as a toddler who like comes out, like falls out of his bed or whatever, his mom goes.
I really thought you were going to say falls out of his mom and I was like, what? Yeah,
toddler as well. Like,
yeah, he goes out of bed and his mom's been taken to this like demon dimension and his bear comes to life and is like, right, let's go get your mom, shall we? So you got to go wander around in all these horrible dream dimensions and try and find it. But it's like,
that sounds really interesting.
It's really interesting. It's not the perfect horror game, but the way that they play with it and how short and contained it is, it's do this, solve this, solve this. Okay, here's the outcome. Mm-hmm. And then it relates everything back to a real societal human fear at the end, and then everything makes sense. You can see how it's all been implemented.
That's
throughout.
Really interesting. I like that. That sounds really good. Would you say that that's one of your sort of like more unexpected horror joys in video gaming, playing that game?
It was one that I didn't know much about when I played it. So I was like, oh, okay, this is really interesting. Again, not the perfect game, not the best horror game you'll ever play, because it's not. But it's really interesting the way that I think that functions as a good example of constructive indie horror.
Because the reason that I ask is because, just to round up this podcast, I was going to ask you both what your sort of best horror video game experiences were, if you have any, and to flip it over, say what was a time where a horror game tried to scare you and just failed miserably.
Go on, Ash.
Don't drop me in the hot water here. I'll start. My favourite one is Outlast. I think Outlast has always been one that I really love. I've always been a massive nerd for found footage horror and the way that that constructs fear through... Oh, no, I'm not going to start all that. This was my dissertation, was found footage horror. But yeah, I think that's a fantastic way of doing it, and having the control of the camera, the lights, all that sort of thing. When I played that, I was genuinely like, ooh. My first playthrough of Dead Space, couldn't do it. I had to make my dad play it and watch him, because I went past that first one that like jumps up, and oh, that's the end of that turn. That's off. And made my dad play it instead. But yeah, those are my favorite ones. Let's do favorite ones.
Yeah. Outlast is genuinely a big one for me. That was like what got me back into horror games in general, because I hadn't really tried any of like those like the new first person ones. And I played that at uni. I think I like just shouted the entire halls down. Like, I was genuinely screaming. I know, I didn't think it could. I thought I'd have to be like really immersed, but I was sort of had the lights on. I was like in a house full of rowdy students drinking in the next room, and I was like, wah! So that is a big one. Yeah. Silent Hill 2, I've mentioned a lot on this podcast. That is huge. The original Resident Evil games, and that's all I can think of right now.
I mean, for me, there's two that immediately spring to my mind, and one of them is Resident Evil 1, but it was the director's cut, which actually flipped a few encounters around. And everyone knows the famous dog jumping through the window scene in the opening. What happened in the director's cut one is you run through, nothing happens. And for anyone who's played, they're like, what's happened here? And then you go, okay, maybe they took it out for some reason, or they're just broken, whatever. You run to there, do some other bits and bobs. 5-10 minutes pass, you run back and there's like do-do-do-do-do, smash. Yeah, so that messed with expectations and completely made me drop trow on that.
Drop trow.
But the other one is in Bioshock, and when you get the shotgun for the first time, it's on the middle of a chair in like a middle of a circle light room. And as soon as you pick it up, you hear that scraping of the... And you just hear like all these splicers start to run into the room, and they're like, you ain't gonna get ya. Congratulations, Fontaine. And then basically, like, you start shooting away at these things, but you go, okay, I can't see them. I don't know where they're coming from. And all I can hear is them screaming and prattling across the ceiling. Oh, it's terrifying, that.
I'm gonna actually throw in another one, right?
Go on then.
Until Dawn, Rush of Blood.
Oh, okay, no, Until Dawn is a straight one.
Until Dawn is amazing. But this stupid VR game where you're on a roller coaster and you're shooting clowns in the face, one of the scariest things I've ever done.
I've never.
It is terrifying. You're strapped into this, like, it's entirely on rails. You've got two guns, which should put you at ease.
Yeah.
But, like, the way, like, the developers just sort of throw these enemies at you, and, like, it's very much sound oriented. Okay. The second level, you're in, like, a pig factory, so you're surrounded by all these oversized pigs. You just soundtracked by like their insane squealing over and over again, like incredibly loud. It is just so unnerving, and like just give me more of that. I don't know why it's so scary, but I need it. And Until Dawn 2, while we're on it.
Fair enough, yeah. Let's talk about a time when they tried to scare you, but you failed.
Honestly, I'm struggling for one off the top of my head.
That's fine.
Struggling because most of the ones I've played, I am a massive, like, ugh. I love horror. I absolutely love it, but I'm so invested in it that it actually gets me most times.
Fair enough.
So I'm always
fair
like, okay, that's actually quite spooky. But yeah, I loved Alone in the Dark and like Alan Wake and all that sort of thing. I'm not ashamed. I liked it.
Wow.
Even that was like, ooh, it's quite spooky. But yeah, it all got to me, so...
I mean, the one that I was thinking of was, I read it in an article and it triggered the memory of Batman Arkham Asylum. You know when you get fear gassed by the Scarecrow?
Yeah.
And at first I was like, wow, this is scary because it's completely messing with the game world itself. And then fast forward 5-10 minutes and it's Batman punching skeletons. And I'm just like, I said, this has gone too far and is now very silly compared to what it was before.
Yep, yep. Outlast 2 for me, sadly. You know what?
Really?
I do enjoy the game. It has some interesting things to say and do, but it tries so hard. And like that can be fine, but it's just too much. It's just unrelenting. It's you can sort of just see through exactly what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
I guess that comes down to pacing, isn't it? It's like if they paced it better, then maybe it would have been there. But they put in so many set pieces into that game that it felt like you were just like, oh God, can't let me catch my breath first.
We don't have time to talk about it now, but I think one of the most important elements of like creating good horror is the downtime. You can't just be at 100 miles per hour for the entire thing, scare, because you need to give people time to catch their breath and then actually be scared. It can't just all be pay off, you know what I mean?
You're talking about the silence in Silent Hill earlier, like when that thing came out, that's like a really big thing, is just saying, okay, no scary noise. There you have it. I'm just trying not to say a swear, so there you have it.
Fontaine.
Congratulations. Anyway, we've done a podcast that was, thank you Scott for going off and letting me try my best to host this, but we hope you've enjoyed this. Let us know down below what all sort of horrific things that you've been scared by in video games, and maybe some stuff that failed to scare you as well. Don't forget to give this a 5-star rating on whatever podcast channel that this goes up on. I'm pretty sure you can listen to it on Spotify, Podbean, something. I should remember this.
Acast.
That's the one.
That's the big one.
That's the big one.
That's the one we have.
But yeah, thank you so much for joining, and thank you to my guest Ash Millman.
Hello, goodbye.
And Josh Brown.
Thank you.
Would you like to plug your own little Twitter handles as well?
Go on then. It's Josh Brune with two O's at the end.
Not in the Brown.
I still wish that it was Juice Brune.
I might change it. You know, Juice Brune's gonna be the full thing.
Okay. Well, when you find Josh, mine is at Ash Millman.
Now, just as we're ending, you might see some.
What is this?
So we're just recording this. If
no
you're listening,
about me not liking the window cleaners.
If you are listening to this, then the window cleaner on our 7-story building has just rocked up and scared the absolute crap out of Ash. And what better way to end this podcast?
They're so unnerving. They see everything.
I've been Jules. Thank you so much, guys, for joining me. And we'll speak to you soon. Bye.
Bye. I'm
Ash
dead.
Has run
I'm
off.
Dead. Ash is gone. Bye. I can't see the faces.
I really hate it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.